Well, hello everybody, and good morning. Thanks, John, for reading this morning, and I hope everyone's well. So, I just wanted to say, firstly, I send love from Lauren and Juliana. Her nap schedule still limits our flexibility, so they're both at home. Lauren's on Zoom, and Juliana's probably asleep, so they wanted to send their love too. So today, the title of my exhortation is "Public Health and the People of Israel." So the year is 1846, and a Hungarian doctor named Ignaz Semmelweis, an assistant professor at John Hopkins School of Public Health. This is considered a time when physicians were expected to have some form of scientific background and training. This is a period of time that is transitional, a time where thinking that evil spirits and bad air were causing an imbalance of the body was becoming a thing of the past. Culture and knowledge were changing. Science was focused on anatomy and objectivity with data collection. He began working at a new job in the General Hospital of Vienna in the maternity clinic. He became interested in why many women in the wards were dying from puerperal fever. At the time, it was also known as childbed fever. He studied two hospitals, one staffed by all female midwives in a clinic and one staffed by doctors and med students who were all male. He found that women in the clinic staffed by doctors and med students were about five times more likely to contract childbed fever and die than those who were born, those women who gave birth at the midwives clinic. A few theories were created by Ignaz. One, women at the midwives clinic gave birth on their side, not on their back, like at the doctor's clinic. So they changed the position of the birthing women to no effect. So the second theory came out. A priest would walk through the doctor's clinic with an assistant ringing a bell. He thought this terrified the women to death, so they changed it to no effect. Ignaz left the hospital and went away for a break. When he returned, he came to find out that one of his good friends, a pathologist, had fallen ill after pricking his finger during an autopsy on a woman who had childbed fever. So Ignaz did some more digging. He found that after the prick incident, his pathologist friend got similar symptomology and died to those women who had childbed fever. However, this still did not answer his question. Why were more women dying in this clinic and not in a midwife's clinic? The major difference he found was that at the doctor's clinic, they were performing autopsies and the midwives were not. He hypothesized cadaverous particles were getting onto the hands of the doctors from the dissected bodies, and when the babies were delivered, these particles would touch the women, get into their bodies, and they would develop the disease and die. He offered his staff and student, he ordered his staff and students to start cleaning their hands and instruments with not just soap, but with chlorine. Today, we know that chlorine is a disinfectant, but Ignaz wanted it to reduce the smell left by the corpses. Once imposed in this clinic, the death rate dropped dramatically. Fellow doctors were angry because Ignaz's hypothesis made them look as if they were to blame for the deaths. He eventually lost his job and was unable to convince any others to follow this very basic hygiene practice of hand hygiene and then even unknowingly to him, disinfecting medical instruments. When we hear stories like this, we think to ourselves, well, that seems to be a common trend in history. Someone with a theory of knowledge tells us something that we're not quite sure about, why or what. But there is something to what they're saying. My daughter Juliana is almost a year and a half now and rapidly growing. Sometimes we give her rules that she is not quite sure why, much to her chagrin. Due to her age, she is getting quite a few childhood vaccines. Myself and Lauren, as her parents, know that she is to get an injection that will be uncomfortable and painful. However, we know that the injection she receives will vaccinate her against some deadly diseases. Juliana, however, does not understand this. Now, when we take her to the cold office, where the evil woman dressed in scrubs works, she thinks to herself, this lady is about to cause me some bodily harm for no reason other than my parents bringing me here. But once Juliana is older, she will most likely not remember these shots, but she will have a greater understanding of the need for them. We can all do or see things happen and never really know the answers to why. However, these questions can be rooted deep in reasoning and explanation. Today, I want to explore with you instances in the Bible that at the time there was little to no understanding of, but ultimately displayed our Father's watchful care over his creation. Time and time again, we see our God guiding Israel. On a macro lens, we understand and scrutinize these commandments. On a micro lens, we can sympathize with the Israelites being inundated with rules, regulations, and restrictions. Today, when we read our Bibles, we read it from our own perspectives. Our interpretations are influenced by our own life experiences, education levels, and cultural perspectives. We live in a digital age. Information is at our fingertips. Information is spread, and it can be translated in all languages for all over the world to see. We know what is happening instantaneously. I am currently taking a continuing education course, and I access peer-reviewed scientific articles all the way from Nigeria to South Korea. The people of Israel had little access to even written information. Their oral history and their laws informed their conduct and their understanding of the world around them. So when we look back through the Bible, we can only barely grasp the level of communication barriers that prophets, disciples, kings, and others faced, from all the way from scientific advancements, passing knowledge, and spreading the word of God would have been a monumental task. Moses was a Hebrew boy by birth, plucked out a river. In Exodus 2, verses 1 to 3, it reads, "Now a man from the house of Levi went and took his wife, a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took him a basket made from bulrushes and dubbed it in bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank." In verse 10, it reads, "When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, I drew him out the water." Moses grew up in the house of Pharaoh, the god king of Egypt. Moses was a prince. He was the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Moses would have had access to some of the highest levels of education offered within the kingdom. In Acts 7, verses 20 to 23, it reads, "At this time, Moses was born, and he was beautiful in God's sight. And he was brought up for 3 months in his father's house. And when he was exposed, Pharaoh's daughter adopted him and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in his words and deeds. When he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel." Moses was instructed in the ways of the adopted parents and families. He would have been accustomed to the ways of the Egyptians, black magic, idol worship, and much more. Moses was 40 years old before it came into his heart to visit his people, the Jews. This is quite a while to have teachings and culture ingrained into you. It was a part of his very identity. As we are all aware, Moses, with God's direction, frees his people from bondage and leads them into the wilderness after the Red Sea parts. He is then given the word of law by God. We see in Exodus 20, God gives Moses the Ten Commandments, laws about altars, slaves, restitutions, social justice, and many more laws that are vital for the spiritual, moral, and physical health of his people Israel. The laws given to the people were specific, strict, black and white at times. The people of Israel were in a state of fragility. They were venturing into the unknown. They, like Moses, were bombarded with cultures of Egypt. They would have been privy to the Egyptian way of life, ideology, religions, healthcare. We are all fully aware of the shroud of mysticism that surrounded the cultures of Egypt. In Leviticus 17, verse 7, "So they shall no more sacrifice their sacrifices to goat demons, after whom they whore. This shall be a statute forever for them throughout their generations." In Joshua 24, verses 14, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord." We also see this recorded in Ezekiel 20, verses 6 to 9. The uphill battle that would be switching from everything that the Jews had become accustomed to was changing. Moses too. We know, as we read, that he was 40 years old before he sought out his people. The law can often be difficult for us to delve into, full of very detailed regulations. I think we can build a greater appreciation for some aspects by looking at it from our modern perspective, through the lens of public health. These laws had important spiritual lessons and applications, but fascinatingly, they were also beneficial to the people of Israel from a public health perspective, especially during their time in the wilderness. A subset of laws I wanted to focus on and explore with you today is health laws given to Moses within Leviticus. Moses, in my opinion, was the first public health official the world has ever had. These laws focused on health were the most advanced public health regulations for the time. They exceeded the scientific understanding of the world at the time, and in my mind, contribute to our faith that these laws were divinely delivered. Moses was performing one of the biggest logistical accomplishments in human history. Moses, with the direction and guidance from God, was to ensure the survival of his people as they wander the wilderness on their way to the promised land. Moses was to communicate the law, ensure adherence to the law, as well as deal with the day-to-day problems that come with sojourning of a nation of people with no home. Throughout history, humans have battled plagues, diseases, and illness, all the way from the 10 plagues in Egypt to the Black Death, to the Spanish flu, to COVID-19. So, here we have the Jews wandering in the wilderness, venturing into the unknown, influenced by their captors. It would be easy to assume that this nation would be far less advanced socially and scientifically. They were a small nation, searching for strength in their identity, torn from everything they knew, that they had become accustomed to. Laws passed through Moses to the people of Israel, to ensure their survival, not only as a people, but as individuals to become a great nation, a symbiotic connection, a set of laws for the people to follow and to hold true. In Leviticus 26:46, during the laws of obedience, it reads, These are the statutes and rules and laws that the Lord made between himself and the people of Israel through Moses on Mount Sinai. In Deuteronomy 4, verses 4 to 8, But you who held fast to the Lord your God are all alive today. See, I have taught you statutes and rules as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do them in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. Keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that the statutes and rules so righteous as this law that I set before you today? So we see the importance of these laws. They are literally a matter of life and death. So let's explore some of them. So Moses, we have the chief public health officer of Israel. The Lord gave Moses the law. Some of these laws pertaining to leprosy were some of the most advanced laws of the time, very effective at limiting the spread of the infectious disease. In Leviticus 13, leprosy jumps onto the scene. It was probably rampant and common before the law focuses on it. The Lord speaks to Moses and Aaron and begins to give laws pertaining to the control, treatment, and actions that should be completed to reduce the spread and assist the people. So let's take a look at leprosy, a disease that has plagued mankind and is well documented throughout history. Leprosy is a chronic infectious disease caused by Mycobacterium leprae. This disease affects the peripheral nerves and skin. It is transmissible from person to person via droplets from the mouth or nose during close and frequent contact with infected, untreated cases. We also know that in the 17th and 18th century, leprosy was tearing through southern Europe, even up to the late 1900s. We even see it was common in Jesus's time, as we see in Luke 17, verses 11 to 19, the healing of the 10 lepers. So how did Moses deal with such a formidable disease? In Leviticus 13, it outlines the laws about leprosy. When we read this chapter, it outlines the rules and parameters for a priest who would assess the person. The guidelines were to go about determining who has a skin disease that would make them unclean, how long they were unclean, and what they should do and where they should live. The identification of unclean afflictions ultimately led to the individual having to be unclean for 7 days and or tearing his clothes, shouting unclean, unclean, or remain unclean, living outside the camp, if it is a chronic ongoing affliction. Leviticus 13, verse 21. But if the priest examines it and there is no white hair in it and it is not deeper than the skin, but has faded, then the priest shall shut him up for 7 days. And if it spreads in the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a disease. But if the spot remains in one place and does not spread, it is a scar of the boil, and the priest shall pronounce him clean. In verse 45, the leprous man who has a disease shall wear torn clothes and let the hair of his head hang loose, and he shall cover his upper lip and cry out, unclean, unclean. He shall remain unclean as long as he has the disease. He is unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. So here in verse 45, wear a mask, cover your upper lip. From our understanding of leprosy, we know it is passed via droplet contact. So if someone coughs or sneezes or you touch the mucous membranes in a nose, you can get leprosy. We're all too familiar with this term due to the COVID-19 pandemic. We see that it did not just stop with masking, diagnoses, and staying away. With the law instructed to them, they had laws instructed them on sterility, disinfecting clothes, beds, and houses. In verse 52, it reads, he shall burn the garment or the warp or the woof, the wool or the linen, or any article made of skin that is diseased, for it is a persistent leprous disease. It shall be burned in the fire. In verses 56 to 59, but if the priest examines and it is disease and the diseased area has faded after it has been washed, he shall tear it out of the garment or the skin or the warp or the woof. Then if it appears again in the garment, in the warp or the woof, or in any article made of skin, it is spreading. You shall burn it with fire, whatever has the disease. But the garment or the warp or the woof, or any article made of skin from which the disease departs when you have washed it, shall then be washed for a second time and it will be clean. This is the law for a case of leprous disease in a garment of wool or linen, even in the warp or the woof or any article made of skin, to determine whether it is clean or unclean. In chapter 14, it moves on to the laws regarding the cleansing of lepers. The chapter outlines a purification process involved in leprosy. In chapter 14, verses 8 to 9, and he who is to be cleansed shall wash his clothes and shave off all his hair and bathe himself in water, and he shall be clean. And after that, he may come into the camp, but live outside his tent 7 days. And on the 7th day, he shall shave off all his hair from his head, his beard, and his eyebrows. He shall shave off all his hair. and he shall wash his clothes and bathe his body in water, and he shall be clean. Jumping back to Leviticus 55 to 58, and the priest shall examine the diseased thing after it has been washed, and if the appearance of the diseased area has not changed through the disease, has not spread, it is unclean. You shall burn it in a fire, whether the rot is on the back or on the front. But if the priest examines it and the disease area is faded, it has been washed, he shall tear it out of the garment or the skin or the warp of the woof. Then, if it appears again in the garment, in the warp or the woof, or in any article made of skin, it is spreading. You shall burn it with fire, whatever has the disease. But the garment or the warp or the woof or any article made of skin from which the disease departs, when you have washed it, shall be washed a second time and made clean. Another example is in chapter 15, verse 11. Anyone the man with discharge touches without rinsing his hands with water must wash their clothes and bathe with water, and they will be unclean till evening. So some pretty heavy rules right there. So we have a bunch of rules outlining how people should deal with those who contract communicable diseases such as leprosy. When we take a close look at the meaning of these laws, we get a sense of a systematic, objective approach in dealing with a contagious disease that is ultimately life-threatening. The law covers from start to finish what is regarded as clean, so not contagious, and what is regarded as clean, contagious. It deals with how to correctly identify between the two, and furthermore, ways to reduce contagion and ways to sterilize belongings through the use of fire, water, and very basic principles of hand hygiene. In our modern era, we are all aware of bacteria, viruses, contagious diseases, and the effect of just standard hand hygiene. But we have access to chemicals, sanitizers, we can sterilize our clothes, our bodies, cell phones, carpets, walls. During the time of the wilderness, these are people with no concept of disease as we know, no concept of sterility, no concept of droplet particles spread in leprosy. They had no concept of hand hygiene or sterilization. The people, including Moses, had these laws telling them parameters of when they should exclude loved ones out the camp limits. Why would God do this? Why would there be such stringent rules? Why should I burn my clothing? Why is one person with white patches on their skin clean, but someone else who has white patches on their skin unclean? Well, with what we know now looking back, for the time they were in, for the periods of knowledge and the ability to comprehend this knowledge, these rules were groundbreaking. To appear one day out of the blue with almost little to no context, they had to follow these rules and trust that these were in their best interests. Just on a side note, in chapter 13, Leviticus chapter 13, verses 38, when a man or a woman has spots on the skin of the body, white spots, the priest shall look. And if the spots on the skin of the body are a dull white, it is leucoderma that has broken out in the skin. He is clean. This is the ESV translation. Others may vary. I wanted to touch on these verses because leucoderma is also commonly referred to as vitiligo or white leprosy. It is not leprosy. It is an autoimmune disorder of the skin that is non-contagious. It affects roughly 0.5 to 2% of the world's population. Even without reference to leucoderma, what is amazing is the differentiation of diseases and their virulence. A law given to the Israelites wandering around the wilderness, being given medical knowledge on differentiation and diagnosis, is astonishing. And for me personally, truly shows the glory of God and our Father's care in his creation. When we read the Bible, we are not limited to just one example. The Bible is a very deep well that we all can explore and gain insight and wisdom from. We'll briefly look at a few more examples. The public health of Israel was not limited to the afflictions of the skin. We see Israel wandering the wilderness. Resources were scarce. Food was a stressor. Even in times of peace, stability, and routine, food was a scarce commodity. So why such stringent rules around food handling? In Leviticus 7:24, the fat of an animal that dies of itself and the fat of one that is torn by beasts may not be put to any other use, but on no account shall you eat it. May be put to any other use, but on no account you should eat it. In Deuteronomy 14, verses 21, you shall not eat anything that has died naturally. You may give it to the sojourner who is within your towns, that he may eat it, or you may sell it to a foreigner, for you are a people holy to the Lord your God. Public health would have a field day if they found out a butcher was caught selling animal flesh that is suspected disease, or any other animal flesh that has touched diseased flesh, even if an animal has died naturally. We also know that animals dying from natural causes doesn't necessarily mean natural in the sense they killed over and died of old age. They could have been infected with disease. I'm sure we can all name a few famous diseases like foot and mouth and bird flu. In Numbers 19 verses 15, the instruction is that any vessel that has no fastened cover on top is unclean. Covering food to reduce transmission from pests, for temperature regulation, others. Bearing in mind, this is laws written thousands of years ago where people had no concept of bacteria or how it grew. In Leviticus 11, clean and unclean animals for consumption are outlined. Why would pork be off the menu? Well, pigs are abundant and easily reared. Same with rabbits. Why would they be off the menu? Well, what we know now is that by just roasting pork and rabbit over an open fire is not enough to kill certain parasites that reside in them. The Israelites were not able to use a thermometer. Another aspect of this law that I found interesting is that even preparation of certain kinds of meat like swine or rabbit, parasites can be transmitted to humans just through raw flesh. Some laws look at waste management. In Deuteronomy 23, 12 to 14, you shall have a place outside the camp and you shall go out to it. And you shall have a trowel with your tools. And when you sit down outside, you shall dig a hole with it and turn back and cover up your excrement. Because the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give up your enemies before you. Therefore, your camp must be holy so that he may not see anything indecent among you and to turn away from you. We also see laws revolving around water management and supply and the importance for it to be clean. In Leviticus 11, 29 to 38, laws outline to not drink from stagnant water or contaminated water that has come into contact with animals and meat. An amazing law, bearing in mind that it was only theorized by John Snow in 1854 that unsanitary water from a drinking water pump was a cause of cholera. And it wasn't proven until 1883 by German scientist Robert Koch. The Mosaic Law is divinely inspired, which is what makes it so complex. Some instructions seem harsh, confusing, and bizarre. To us, the people in the Middle Ages, Victorian doctors, are most likely to the Jews. In the law of God, there is no bias, no ignorance, no superstition. The Israelites at this time were primitive in knowledge and technology. They left essentially with the shirts on their backs. For the time period and culture they were in, they would not have had access to such complex knowledge regarding things like sanitation, food handling, and controlling leprosy outbreaks. In 2 Timothy 3, verses 16 and 17, it reads, "All scripture is breathed out by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete and equipped for every good work." The law of Moses, on a spiritual level, points us to Jesus, but on a practical level, it also helped ensure the survival of Israel, limiting their exposure to infectious diseases through highly advanced scientific practices. In Psalm 19, verses 7 to 9, the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The rules of the Lord are true and righteousness altogether. Another quick example, in Genesis 17:12, the direction to circumcise on the eighth day. With the modern medicine, we now know that newborns have efficient blood clotting factors on the eighth day of life. Newborns are at risk for controlled bleeding if done earlier. The commandment, bearing in mind, was roughly around 4,000 years ago. We also see this restated to Moses in Leviticus 12:3. With modern medicine, we know that the eighth day is when newborns have efficiently developed blood clotting factors. So looking back to Ignaz, finding a correlation between the cadaver use and childbed fever, we know that in Numbers 19:11-19, washing after handling a dead body is prescribed. We know now that dead bodies can still spread infectious agents such as hepatitis B and C, TB and cholera, and a variety of other pathogens. In Numbers 13:11, it reads, "Whoever touches the dead body of any human being will be unclean for 7 days." As we see with the law, there were times when the people of God were called to obey, even if they did not understand the reasoning behind God's direction. We're all likely familiar with laws instructing Noah to build the ark in anticipation for when the floods come, for a new world to start over. Noah was given specific measurements to adhere to when constructing the ark, which ultimately allowed him and his family to survive the flood. At the time, though, Noah's obedience was an act of faith, building a boat on dry land. We also see other benefits from the aspects of the law in an agricultural sense. In Leviticus 25, verses 1 to 24, to summarize, on techniques of crop rotation, the law instructs the Israelites to set aside 1 year and 7 to raise no crops. God promised a good harvest in the 6th year to tide them over on the 7th of no growth. Insects winter in the stalks of the harvest growth and will hatch in the spring. This egg-laying cycle happens over and over until there is a pest control issue. The 7th year would drastically reduce winter in insects and control the population. We have an insight of modern scientific advances to understand the reasoning of why certain aspects of the law may have been beneficial to the people of Israel in practical ways. As I say, such as food hygiene, the control of infection, increased agricultural yields. From our perspective, many of these practices are reasonable and make sense. However, the Israelites would not have had our understanding of the world. They followed these detailed prescriptions of conduct with the basis of faith, knowing that God had directed them to do so. Even if they didn't understand the why, they were obedient because they had faith that God was actively leading them. As we bring our attention to the table, we can also reflect on the obedience of Jesus, who was a fulfillment of the law. Although he had profound understanding of the ways and purposes of God, he still humbled himself, as we see in Philippians 2. Even to death on a cross, he demonstrated his faith through God through obedience. Like the people of Israel, our understanding of the ways of God remains limited by our own knowledge and understanding. We are sometimes called to do things that are difficult or forced to endure situations which are challenging. But like the people of Israel, we too can choose to obey, trusting that the path of discipleship to which we are called is shaped by God, whose understanding is far beyond ours. In Isaiah 55:8-11, it reads, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways. Your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. As the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return to it without watering the earth and making it bud and flourish, so that it yields seed for the sower and bread for the eater, so is my word that goes out from my mouth. It will not return to me empty, but will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it. Through the sacrifice of Jesus, we are no longer under the law, but are called to live by the Spirit. And in finishing, I'm going to read Romans 8, verses 1 to 16. Therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus, because through Christ Jesus, the law of the Spirit who gives life has set you free from the law of sin and death. For what the law was powerless to do because it was weakened by the flesh, God did by sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh to be a sin offering. And so he condemned sin in the flesh, in order that the righteous requirement of the law might be fully met in us, who do not live according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. Those who live according to the flesh have their minds set on what the flesh desires, but those who live in accordance with the Spirit have their mindset set on what the Spirit desires. The mind governed by the flesh is death, but the mind governed by the Spirit is life and peace. The mind governed by the flesh is hostile to God. It does not submit to God's law, nor can it do so. Those who are in the realm of the flesh cannot please God. You, however, are not in the realm of the flesh, but are in the realm of the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God lives in you. And if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, they do not belong to Christ. But if Christ is in you, then even though your body is subject to death because of sin, the Spirit gives life because of righteousness. And if the Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead is living in you, he who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies because of his Spirit who lives in you. Therefore, brothers and sisters, we have an obligation, but it is not to the flesh, to live according to it. For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the misdeeds of the body, you will live. For those who are led by the Spirit of God are the children of God. The Spirit you receive does not make you slaves so that you live in fear again. Rather, the Spirit you received brought about your adoption to sonship. And by him we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are God's children. Now, if we are the children, then we are heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ, if indeed we share in his sufferings, in order that we may also share in his glory. Thank you for your kind attention.